This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
Welcome to UCSD Guestbook. I'm David Ringrose from the UCSD Department of History, and our guest today is Professor Felipe Fernandez Armesto. Felipe was born from a Spanish family, but in England and grew up there. His education was both in Spain and England. The last several years he has taught at Oxford University and more recently at the University of London. He's the author of several books, several is probably an understatement, some about Ferdinand Isabella and Spanish expansion between the 13th and 16th century. More recently, he's taken on a considerably more ambitious scope for his work and talks about himself, or people talk about him, as a scholar of ecological and environmental history. He has, in recent years, published The Times Illustrated History of Europe, and an ambitious book entitled Millennium, A History of the Last 1,000 Years. The conversation today centers on his most recent and even more ambitious book, entitled in the first edition in England and Canada, simply Civilization. For the American audience, it has now been published as Civilizations, Culture, Ambition, and the Transformation of Nature. I would start, I think, with perhaps a two-part question. Possibly it has only one answer, but it came to me as two parts. The first part is, how do you define civilization? And how does your interest in ecological and environmental history provide a framework for the topic?
Oh, well, thank you, David. I don't think there's any question that has only one answer. But both of your questions could generate a lot of answers. By civilization, I mean a relationship with the environment, a strenuous, ambitious mm-hmm. relationship, a commitment to change the environment, to transform nature, to conform to human uses, to remodel mm-hmm. it according to ideas which arise in human minds. I'm very dissatisfied with traditional ways of defining civilization, because I think they're all self-interested or self-congratulatory. Mm-hmm. Civilization has become one of those much abused words like freedom and democracy, which people use to mean whatever they want it to mean, and usually they want it to mean a kind of self-congratulatory formulation in which civilization is identified either with features of the society that the speaker mm-hmm. himself inhabits, or in a sort of utopian way with features of society which he would like to inhabit mm-hmm. if he could. I wanted to try and get away from that rather value-charged, self-referential way of looking at what civilization means. And I turned to what I think is a kind of common sense technique. I tried to look at all the societies mm-hmm. which we commonly call civilizations and ask what they have in common. And I think it's that commitment to environmental modification. For example, I don't think it makes sense to say that cities are a necessary ingredient of civilization because the word has an etymology which is connected with classical terms of about urban living. But I think it does make sense to use cities as an index of how civilized people are because they are very extreme forms of environmental modification. I mean, cities are things which actually crush the landscape and refashion it in ways which are unnatural in the sense that you wouldn't find them in a landscape unmodified by man. And I think the same applies to agriculture. You know, people commonly say that you can't have civilization without agriculture. I wouldn't necessarily go along with that, but I think the reason, a good reason for identifying agricultural societies with civilizations is that agriculture also really dramatically refashions the environment. It scores it with a sort of geometry that arises from human physical needs and in the human imagination.
So it becomes a way of breaking away from the conventional sort of civilization's course, which has become very popular in the United States, at least, where you have Europe and Rome and China and the Muslim world and a few other sort of great civilizations of that sort, and throwing in, if possible, the Aztec and the Inca, and instead looks not so much at the scope of the civilization as what they have done to the context within which they live, which might not necessarily be that large geographically.
Well, of course,
or might be dispersed over great distances and not even contiguous.
I mean, I think I cover all the societies you mentioned one way or another in the book, but I also include rather more surprising cultures which people don't conventionally think of as civilized, because I don't think that civilization is something that we have and other people haven't got. I think it's a scale along which people position themselves, and some people choose to take a really ambitious attitude to nature and try to reform it in dramatic and exciting and challenging and very often risky ways. And there are other peoples who have a more modest, a more deferential attitude to nature.
What are some of the examples of cultures or peoples that have ended up with what you might call the minimalist approach to civilization,
well,
as you're talking
about?
Well, of
course, in the book I divide the material up not people by people, but environment by environment. I mean, I think if there's something really original, apart from, there's something rather polemical in my attempt to change the way we think about civilization. But if there's something original in the methodology of the book, it's the way I divide it up environment by environment instead of culture by culture or period by period. I don't think anybody's ever tried to cover world history in environmental categories before. And I argue that even in environments which we conventionally think of as uncivilizable, like the ice worlds of the tundra and taiga, the boreal Arctic, there are some heroic cases of cultures which have made dramatic interventions in an environment, particularly when you consider how hostile that kind of environment is to the sort of adaptations that human beings can contemplate. Things like the Dorset culture amongst the Inuit, which invented the soapstone seal oil powered lamp, which enabled them to penetrate for purposes of hunting environments which would otherwise be completely inaccessible to people. Or in the old world, Arctic, I've got quite a lot of stuff about the Sami and the Samoyeds, the Nenets and the Ostiaks and the Chukchi, those really heroic peoples of the far north who have practiced the selective breeding of reindeer, the domestication of reindeer flocks, which, again, when you consider this in the context of the sort of environment they're up against, seems to me to be a pretty heroic, civilizing step. But I also cover, peoples like the Bushmen, the San, as some people choose to call them, of South Africa, who are almost a universal model of a people who reject civilization, who prefer to practice a life of conformity and deference to the environment around them, and whose interventions are very few. Even they have practiced, as I try to show, very sophisticated hunting technologies, which do represent, again, a formidable civilizing step. And of course, really, as far as we know, there's no people, no human community that we know of that hasn't intervened in the environment, at least by using fire, to control.
Right. But now what you're suggesting is that there's boundaries are probably not the best word, but a place where you move from adapting to the environment to adapting the environment.
Yes. I mean, I don't think there's a point. As I say, I think it's a scale. I think it's a continuum. And you can point to a threshold beyond which you can start saying that some people are civilized and some people aren't. But I do think, this is where the book becomes dangerously politically incorrect. I do think you can say that some people are more civilized than others. Two caveats, though. When you say some people are more civilized than others, you mustn't think this means they're necessarily better in any absolute sense, because for some purposes it's a more rational strategy to be less civilized than to be more civilized, because the less you adapt to the environment, the less you challenge it, the less risk you have of your civilization collapsing in ecological disaster. And you know, the world is actually strewn with the ruins of over-ambitious civilizations that dared too much and that, through over-exploitation of the environment, ended up wrecked. Whereas, you know, you can actually see them competing in certain environments with other cultures who are less ambitious and who've survived for longer. I devote quite a long passage in the book to the encounter in 11th century Iceland between the relatively civilizing, ambitious Norse colonists and the relatively more modest, more environmentally sensitive, if you like, Thule Inuit, who colonized that island at the same time, virtually the same time, coming from the opposite direction, both peoples arriving by heroic navigations, the Norse across the Atlantic, the Thule people by navigating the Arctic rim of the North American continent. And they meet in Greenland and they practice contrasting strategies for survival. The Norse build cathedrals of stone. They import timber and nails to build huge ships. They introduce their own crops and their own livestock. And, you know, within 400 years, they've disappeared. The Thule don't do any of that. And, you know, they're still there. So in some respects, for some purposes, it's better to be less civilized than more civilized. And the second caveat you've got to bear in mind, I think, is that it's a bit like, you know, when you judge one student against another, you've got to take into account their background, their capacity, their disadvantages, and you've got to weight the grade you give them accordingly. And similarly, when I say that some peoples are more civilized than others, I build into the model the difficulty of the environment they're coping with, so that I think that some peoples whom we underestimate historically come out rather better than the Western civilization on which we so often over-congratulate ourselves, and which actually arose when it originated in a relatively easy environment to adapt the temperate post-glacial forests of Northern and Western Europe, which you can adapt quite easily by destroying them and cutting them down, which essentially is what Europeans did.
Now, one of the tensions or themes that runs through the book, at least for me, is a kind of a tension between the individual and the societies that organize what civilizations do and create. Individuals presumably make reasoned decisions about their own lives, but they also get sucked in or coerced into supporting the agendas of controlling elites and rulers. Have any societies done better or worse in this regard, in your mind?
Well,
Which ones would you have preferred to live in?
I don't think I share your faith in the rationality of the individual. If it were true that our individual actions, were governed by reason, I don't think I would ever have written this book, which is, you know, calculated to provoke almost everybody, possibly to the point of offence. The easiest thing for me to do is to leap to the point at which you ended the question and say, which society would I like best? And I spent hundreds and hundreds of pages defending all these, you know, peoples whom we've traditionally regarded as very primitive and backward and savage and designated by all these very pejorative terms. I've devoted a lot of space to pointing out how relatively ambitious and heroic their lives are, and it is a sort of vindication. It's a culturally pluralistic account of civilizations. That's why it's called civilizations in the plural. It's meant to be a tribute to Kenneth Clark's great book, Civilization, which I think in America has the bowdlerized title. The latest American edition, I think, is just called Western Civilization. But Kenneth Clark called it civilization because that, to him, was what it was. The West was the acme of history, the product of historical evolution. And I've called it civilizations in order to stress to the reader that this is a sort of pluralistic alternative, a multiple vision of the diversity of human achievements in different environments. Nevertheless, you know, I've got to admit, if you press me, and if I'm candid in my answer, I have to say that, like everybody else, I like the society I live in. And I'm not an eco-freak. I mean, although I'm a historical ecologist, I have to admit that I love the dynamic, frenetic cities that we've created in the industrial and post-industrial world. I love their cultural amenities, and I hate nature. You know, I mean, to me, nature is something that I like to look at through my study window, and I don't like to go out and interact with it.
This puts me in mind of a book I read years ago, and you may or may not like the comparison. It was by Harold Nicholson called Good Behavior.
Oh, no, I'm always delighted to be compared. He analyzes
the standards for good behavior in several societies and suggests that as time goes on, this gets better, but that the ultimate epitome is Harold Nicholson in his studio as a British gentleman.
Yes. Well, I certainly don't see myself as the last word in evolution, and I don't see myself as the
but
product.
Translating it to
disregard.
Civilizations.
But in terms of personal taste, I mean, I don't feel there's any consistency in admitting candidly that I like the society that I live in best, but that I can still accord to others the esteem which objectively they deserve. And one of the reasons, you know, for adopting this environmental system of classification, this environmental criterion for judging how civilized a people is that, you know, that there is something objective about the environment. It really is out there. Unlike most of our techniques for historical categorization, which are constructed in our own minds, the environment is really there. You know, you can go out and you can feel it. You can feel the rain on your face and the wind in your hair and the sun on your back. And if somebody tells me, you know, that the environment is mentally constructed, I would do what Dr. Johnson said. I would say I refute it thus and kick my foot against a rock. Of course, you know, one can have long disagreements about how to relate the way we organize and classify our life ways to that environmental reality. But the existence of that environmental reality is beyond doubt. And I'm trying, by bringing it centrally, you know, into my formula, to give my formula a kind of objectivity which I don't think other analyses of what civilization is have got.
Now, a minute ago, and also in an earlier conversation, you were somewhat skeptical about the sort of reasonableness or rationality of individuals. And in particular, in one conversation, we talked about the idea that economic man makes rational decisions about using his resources and creating, you know, the kind of modern capitalism that supposedly is part of this current society that's perhaps better than some of the others. But in your book, you also go at some length or are somewhat flattering, if that's the right word, of the capitalist skills of peoples like the Dutch and the Gujaratis in India. Now, is there a contradiction in this?
Well, I hope not. There may be creative tension, would be my word. You may prefer the word contradiction. The answer to the question about economic man, about whether we really all are pursuing our enlightened self-interest in the way that capitalist theory suggests, the answer to that is, if you're so clever, why aren't you rich? I mean, I don't think if you were to tabulate people's reasonableness and their skill in ratiocination against their competence in economic management, I think you'd find there's a very great mismatch. And, you know, I don't think history has got many lessons, but I mean, one of them is that capitalism may be the best economic system we've come up with so far, but it hasn't fulfilled its own predictions. You know, I mean, we now do have pretty thoroughly capitalist world, and it's a terrible world. You know, it's run by chaos capitalism, and there are a lot of losers out there, and we still haven't found a way of coping with them and getting around that problem and integrating them into a world of prosperity. So, I mean, I'm not convinced that the results have justified our recent, much vaunted confidence in this capitalist concept of economic man. But you're right that I'm a great admirer of peoples who set themselves capitalist agendas and succeed in them. I mean, I think that's only fair. It doesn't mean that I necessarily think that those capitalist agendas represent the best way of managing the world. It does mean that I think that when people set themselves a task and achieve it in conformity with their objectives, they deserve credit for it. And it is, to me, remarkable. I mean, what I wanted to do in the book was to bring out the fact that capitalism isn't just a Western virtue or vice, that it's very widely dispersed system around the world, and that some of the most spectacular capitalist ventures have been launched from cultures very different from our own, because I think we've tended to think, you know, that capitalism is somehow the West's gift to the world, and there's this, you know, further myth that it's part of the Protestant tradition and that it derives from a kind of Protestant ethos, a gospel of work. I think all of that is completely false, and the proof that it's false is in the very large number of successful capitalist cultures that you find around the world. And in the book, I spend a lot of time discussing Jainism and the way you mentioned Gujarat. I mean, I think that if there is a culture of capitalism, a religion of capitalism, it might be Jainism rather than Protestantism.
Along the way, you've implied that many of the goals for successful civilizations are, at least to our eyes, irrational. That why build cathedrals instead of canals is in a sense, the question you raise. And you also
suggest that's a very good way of putting it. I must make a note of that for future editions.
You also suggest that most civilizations end up in rebuilding their environments, also destroying their environments, and this then has a lot to do with their ultimate lack of success. Now, is this penchant for irrational goals necessarily connected with the fact that civilization destroys the environment it lives in? Or is that inherent in just the civilizing process?
Well, of course, I'm not much of a believer in golden ages. I mean, I think that in all societies, our species is in competition with others and is searching for ways of exploiting others. Whether it's right to use the term rational of strategies which devise methods of enduring for a long time or not is, however, an open question, I think, because, you know, long-term survival may not be your objective. Spectacular short-term achievement may be what you're after, to have kind of cosmic binge. I mean, very often when one looks at the monuments of antiquity, Kenneth Clark said that civilization was building in confidence for the future, having a sort of notion of posterity. I'm not sure, when I look at the evidence of a lot of civilizations who've left their ruins around the world, whether they really necessarily always thought like that. And, you know, when in ancient Rome, when they built the Golden House, or when in Egypt they built the Pyramid of Cheops, these were meant surely to be monuments of the moment. And I don't think they expected posterity to do anything except, you know, stand and gape at them in wonder.
Now, near the end of the book, you suggest that civilization, in the larger sense, has shifted its geographic focus from one ocean to another, down to approximately 1500, the Indian Ocean, the last three or four centuries, the Atlantic Ocean, and perhaps now, beginning in the late 20th century, into the Pacific Ocean. If that's what actually is going on, what do you see as the role of, say, Europe or the United States in a world where civilization has its focus in the Pacific?
Well, I don't think the Pacific phase, if there is one, or if there's going to be one, of the history of global civilization is necessarily going to be a very long phase. I mean, it pains me to say this. In San Diego, on the edge of the Pacific, where I've been enjoying, you know, the sparkle of the sun on the water all morning. But I reckon, you know, if you Pacific shore dwellers really want to enjoy your moment, you should You should plunge into it and do it whilst you can, because one of the things that's happened, one of the things one notices about history is that its pace seems to have been increasing. Turnover in civilization seems to have been increasing as time has gone on. And as you rightly say, there was this sort of Indian Ocean civilization, as one might call it, which has lasted for a very long time, has been supplanted by the Atlantic, which has lasted relatively briefly and which is already being supplanted by that of the Pacific. I say, you know, half in jest, that maybe the next world civilization is going to be that of the Arctic, and you can already see how the Arctic is becoming a very important avenue of communications, aerial communications and submarine communications, and you can imagine a time in the future where maybe the Arctic will start carrying more trade, more commerce, more cultural transmissions than the Pacific does today. And it might happen surprisingly quickly. You know, if you're on the Pacific, enjoy it whilst you can.
Let me throw you one last question, and it's a matter of throwing some words back at you from your own conclusion. At the end of the book, you say, there is no remedy except to go on trying and keeping civilized traditions alive. So what would be the civilizing or civilized traditions that you would like to keep alive?
I make no apology for appealing to tradition, because I think it's, if there is such a thing as progress, then tradition is the foundation of it. And no society has ever improved by forgetting the past. You know, you've really got to build on what you've got. And for me, because I regard civilization as a process of encounter with and adaptation of the rest of nature, the key elements of the tradition are probably threefold. First of all, one's got to remain conscious of the awareness which has gradually grown upon us that there is no sharp distinction between us and the environment. We're all part of the same continuum. Human beings are part of the animal kingdom. It's in our nature to be civilized. There's ultimately no conflict between civilization and nature, so we can go on.
And the second would be?
Pursuing the civilizing project in awareness of that. The second is that although our efforts to differentiate ourselves from nature are founded on a myth, it's a very noble myth, and its consequences have been very enriching. You know, they've added to the diversity of life. Yeah. And although, you know, we may not be right in identifying civilization with art and high culture, those have been byproducts of our mistakes, which have been very worthwhile, and we want to go on with them. And the final thing is we've got to look for that balance in our relationship with nature, which is going to enable us to conserve and survive, as well as modifying for our own satisfaction in daring, ambitious, and spectacular ways.
Well, thank you very much, Felipe, for this wonderful discussion. And I'd like to thank you and the audience for watching Guestbook with us.